Right now on the Daily Debrief, testimony about trajectory in the case of a Dallas police officer who shot and killed a man in his own apartment, which she says she mistook for her own apartment. One of our guests says it isn't murder.
Quite frankly, I think it's shameful to upgrade it that far.
And the case of the Florida law professor shot and killed. Prosecutors suggest the victim's ex-wife's family may have been behind it.
And her problem was named Dan Markell.
The solution?
And to execute Mr. Markell in cold blood.
The defense tells jurors not to trust a witness with a so-called deal of the century.
7 years in Florida State Prison.
Plus,
Sugar Plum didn't only touch lives through death, she also touched lives through living.
A verdict for the man accused of murdering a 9-year-old girl. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Thursday, September 26.
Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. For those of you watching here on the Law and Crime Network, we're here early today so the network can continue live coverage of the murder trial of Amber Guyger into the evening. Guyger, of course, is the Dallas police officer accused of shooting and killing Botham Jean. Guyger went home, opened the door, saw the victim, and opened fire, thinking he was an intruder. That's her side of the story. She was in the wrong apartment and realized it after she fired. Three attorneys, are with us tonight. We have Latonia Hines here in New York, former federal prosecutor Francie Hakes is with us. Jesse Weber, my fellow host here on the Law and Crime Network, also joins us for this coverage. The victim's next door neighbor said she was sitting on her couch talking to her boyfriend when she heard two gunshots and then commotion in Dallas.
We're chatting and all of a sudden I heard a very loud sort of metallic sound. It sounded like two parts to one noise, if that makes sense. My boyfriend could hear it through the phone as well. We both stopped for a second, and about 5 seconds later, it sounded like a commotion, like a man's voice and a woman's voice, some like yelling, and it sounded like running or slamming, something like that. So at that point, I jumped up from the couch and ran to my front door to look out the peephole. I couldn't see anything, so I put my ear to the crack to kind of listen. At that point, it was silent for about 10 seconds, and then I heard what sounded like a female calling 911.
A trace evidence examiner testified that she was unable to give a determination on the distance between the gun and the victim when Amber Guyger pulled the trigger. The expert said her lack of a firm opinion is rooted in the potential for material transfer.
Range of fire would be a different testing performed at the laboratory. This type of gunshot residue that I look at, it's not suitable for that type of analysis.
So you can't give us any kind of an expert opinion. You wouldn't even try and give us an expert opinion as to how far or how close the shooter was to the complainant.
No, I can only say that gunshot residue, once it comes out of the gun or the firearm, will travel certain distance downrange and to the sides of that firearm. And the quantity and how far it goes, it will depend on the type of firearm, the type of ammunition, and the environmental conditions.
The medical examiner testified that Botham Jean was shot in the left side of the chest and that the fatal bullet was recovered from a muscle in the victim's spine. The prosecutor then gave a demonstration on the possible trajectory of that bullet.
I'm not the same size, but is this roughly the angle you're talking about?
Yeah, I would pull the bottom more forward.
So,
rotate the bottom end more forward towards your belly button. There you go.
Okay. Yep. Like this. Now, and it could happen in a number of ways. Mr. Hermes talked about a couple. If a individual were facing a person, if walking up towards a person, and saw a firearm, if they ducked and the person shot at them, that could cause that type of deal, as long as it's that relation?
If you're flexed forward like that, yes.
Okay. And that could happen a number of ways. A person can duck quickly and be in that position?
Well, it's not only the ducking, but it's also moving your forward portion of the torso
right over,
yes.
Am I positioned that way?
It appears so, yes.
Okay. And when I got that way, I was ducking, correct?
Yes.
Okay. As long as it's in that position, and however you get there, ducking or bowing or whatever, that could be a scenario.
That would be consistent.
Forensic death examiner Joseph Scott Morgan analyzed the trajectory for us here at Law and Crime.
The only thing that we know for sure is that Mr. Jean was facing the officer when the weapon was discharged and he was struck. Beyond that, it's really hard to kind of extrapolate what his physical attitude was. He was potentially tilted forward. But you don't know what that means. You know, my gosh, you know, somebody walks into the room, I'm going to be inquisitive. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to want to look. But that doesn't mean he's attacking. He might very well and probably was just inquiring, you know, what the hell are you doing in my house is what it comes down to. She shot this man in his apartment. Now, I don't know how the jury's going to process all of that, but it doesn't look good for her.
Earlier in this case, prosecutors showed the jury body camera footage from responding police officers. Watch it again and look for the red doormat in front of the victim's front door. Then notice the distance between the door and the area where the victim lay waiting for help to arrive. Questions about those facts are key to the state's case.
The video starts in the parking garage at the apartment complex where Amber Geiger and Botham Jean lived. Officers struggled to enter. Defendant Amber Geiger gave 911 dispatchers the code to open the gate. Then the frantic officers ran up the stairs, trying to reach the fourth floor where the shooting occurred. They arrive, then snake through the labyrinth-like corridors to Botham Jean's apartment. The defendant's voice attracted their attention. Inside, a shaken defendant said she thought she was in her own apartment when she pulled the trigger.
I thought it was my apartment.
Geiger said she shot Botham Jean in the top left. She shot twice, but only struck him once. Then the first responders tried in vain to save Jean's life. Jean died at the hospital.
I spoke earlier today about this case with Atlanta attorney Philip Holloway. He urged trial watchers to trust law enforcement's view of the case and to critically judge the prosecutor's decisions to indulge the grand jury to upgrade the charges against defendant Amber Geiger.
I think that at most, you might have some type of criminal negligence. I think that even that might be a stretch because that's sort of in the eye of the beholder. But certainly going for murder, I think, is a bridge too far. She is presumed innocent. She needs to be tried, if at all, or investigated based on the facts of the case. And the facts in this case, as found by the investigating officer, are very clear. There is not much room to go beyond those and to start speculating about what else might have been going on. And that's what's been the problem with this case from the beginning. The prosecutor is basically, I think, looking at this case and saying, we've got to go ahead and up these charges. Everybody's saying, look, well, the grand jury did it. Well, the grand jury does what the prosecutor asked them to do. Everybody knows that. So it's a little bit of a farce to blame this on the grand jury. This murder indictment is squarely at the feet of the prosecutor. And quite frankly, I think it's shameful to upgrade it that far.
Our guests are here now for context on this. Latonia Hines, you're a prosecutor. You just heard Philip Holloway say the state should never have even brought this as a murder case and that he believes it wasn't even a crime, basically. So do you agree or do you disagree with that assessment?
I think that you can't go and second guess what the prosecution's doing. I have respect for Phil. I know that Phil used to be a former prosecutor himself, but they are looking at the facts that this officer, and on some levels, I think they're thinking at this idea that she is held to a higher standard, whether or not we want to believe that or not, that she should have made more precautions, should have been more aware because on some levels of her training before she shot that gun.
Francie Hakes, former federal prosecutor, same question. Is this a murder case in your opinion? Is this a lesser crime? Is it no crime at all?
Well, I don't think the prosecution has, I don't think it's a bridge too far. I don't necessarily agree with Phil. Phil and I used to work together. I don't necessarily agree with Phil that it's a bridge too far, but I do think he has a point in the murder charge. And if the prosecution wants the jury to convict her of murder, they're going to have to show a motive. They're going to have to show more than a police officer should have known better, or this is suspicious because she's a police officer and her training should have prevented her from some sort of accidental shooting, so we can just assume there's something else going on. If they don't give the jury that something else, whatever it is, an actual motive to kill this man, they're never going to convict this officer of murder.
That's an interesting viewpoint, Francie, because in Texas, they don't really have to prove premeditation or motive, in my understanding. So why try to suggest it if it's not necessary?
Well, it's never an element of the crime. Motive is never an element of a crime in any state that I'm aware of. But still, the prosecutor is obliged to prove it. A jury wants to hear it. And that's what I mean. It's not an element. But if the prosecutors don't give it to the jury, I don't think the jury will convict.
Jesse Weber, where do you sit on this one?
See, I just look at the statute, and Texas is pretty broad. If you intentionally or knowingly are causing the death of another person or serious bodily injury, that's all that matters. If she knew that by firing that weapon, it was going to cause the death or seriously injure him, that's all that you need. She understood it. As I'll say it once, I'll say it again. It's not as if she fired at something thinking it was a mannequin and it turned out to be a human being. It's not as if she fired her gun in the air and it hit a tree and then landed and hit somebody. She knew what she was doing at that moment. The question is, was she justified? Is there an affirmative defense that can protect her?
Exactly, Latonia. Factually, the jury needs to decide a lot here. One of the big questions is whether or not the jury is going to decide to believe the defendant when she said she thought was that she rather was in her own apartment, basically right up to the shooting itself. It's tough, though, to get inside somebody else's head. Is that story believable? Is the defendant covering for herself? What does the jury make of that?
So it's very, very hard. And what's going to have to happen? We've debated this over and over again. I think she's got to take the stand. She's got to take the stand and make the jurors feel what she felt that night and make them believe that she truly could, like they could believe it too, that she truly could have gone into this apartment thinking it was her own. And what would you do if you go into an apartment and you open the door and you see this person here? You know they wouldn't be there except for something bad. But it's very hard for her on the same level too if you're the prosecutor looking at this, because she should have known. We've got the red carpet. We've got so many other things that should have alerted her before she pulled the gun and actually pulled the trigger.
Francie, a lot of law piling up here, stacking up here for the jury to kind of go through. We've got mistake of fact. We've got reasonableness. We've got justifiable self-defense. How do we unravel all of that and make that really clear to the jury? I expect a lot of consideration in jury instructions in this case.
You know, Aaron, it's interesting. Jury instructions are so confusing, and I'm not sure juries really listen to them. I hate saying that, but it's a fact. What the jury wants to know is, did someone want to kill the person who's dead? And I think here you've also got the complicating factor that she's a police officer, and like it or not, police officers get a higher level of respect from the community. They get deference because the community knows that the community is almost never in a similar situation as a police officer. So they give her judgment almost a higher level. And I think that's why I say, Jesse's absolutely right, it's not in the statute. But I think that's why if the prosecutor doesn't prove that she had a reason to kill or that this was just so reckless and depraved that it rises to the level of murder, the jury's never going to find her guilty.
And the latter, I think, is what the prosecutor is trying to do here, pointing out all the signs that the defendant could have noticed to realize that she wasn't in the right place. We're going to move along, though. Still ahead here on The Debrief, a verdict in the case of a Florida man accused of sex crimes and murder the victim, a 9-year-old girl. You will hear from her mother. Plus, opening statements in a complicated murder case involving a Florida law professor and two defendants. One blames the other. The other one says he didn't do it. A guilty verdict in the death penalty trial of a Florida man accused of killing a 9-year-old girl. Felicia Williams disappeared in 2014 and her naked body later turned up on a causeway in Old Tampa Bay. Defendant Granville Ritchie, who also goes by Trevor, now stands convicted of sexually assaulting the girl, beating her and strangling her to death. Here is the jury's verdict.
We have your finest call of ask to count one of the charge of the defendant's guilt of first-degree murder. The killing was premeditated murder and felony murder based on a final guilt by sexual battery. Victim less than 12, defendant over 18. We the jury find this fall as to count two other charges. Defendant is guilty of sexual battery. Victim less than 12 years of age, defendant over 18 of age as charged. We the jury find this fall as to count three other charges. Defendant is guilty of aggravated child abuse as charged.
This case now turns to the penalty phase, where the state seeks to convince the jury that the defendant should die for his crime. The victim's mother's statement here was powerful, and so powerful, in fact, that one of the jurors was brought to tears.
I knew when she was first born that she would be my special child. And that's because she had that drive and will and was always determined to make things happen. Even though Felicia was 9 years old, she was very smart, advanced, and very wise beyond her years. Like an elderly person would say, she was an old soul. She was a cheerleader. She sang faithfully in the youth choir at the New Zion Holiness Church, where I am a faithful member. And she never departed from her mommy without telling me that she loved me. Sugar Plum didn't only touch lives through death, she also touched lives through living. Felicia's death has affected my life and took its toll on my entire family. Even though it's been 5 years, it feels like 5 days ago. You truly will never understand what a unique individual you took from us.
The penalty phase of that case is scheduled to wrap up tomorrow. And finally, tonight here on The Debrief, opening statements in the trial of an on-again, off-again Florida couple accused of murdering a law professor. The victim in this case, Dan Markell, was in a nasty custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy. Prosecutors point to this battle as a potential motive for Markell's death. Neither Wendy nor any of her family have been charged. The defendants are Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine Magbuana. Here, the prosecutor lays out the alleged connections between the defendants and the victim.
Rivera will tell you that he was hired by his lifelong friend, Sigfredo Garcia, who was hired by his longtime girlfriend and children's mother, Catherine Magbanawa, a.k.a. Katie, to come to Tallahassee and to kill Dan Markell. Magbanawa had an on-again, off-again relationship with Mr. Garcia, and during one of the off-again periods, you will learn prior to the murder, during one of these off-again periods with Mr. Garcia, she was seeing somebody else, a wealthy dentist by the name of Charlie Adelson. Charlie Adelson had a sister in Tallahassee, Wendy Adelson, and Wendy Adelson had a problem, and her problem was named Dan Markell. And the solution to that problem was Magbanawa, Rivera, and Garcia.
A key witness expected to testify is Luis Rivera, a third alleged conspirator. Sigfredo Garcia's attorney claims prosecutors gave a known member of the Latin Kings gang the, quote, deal of the century in exchange for testifying against his client, who he claims is innocent.
Donna Adelson, Charlie Adelson, Wendy Adelson, that's who their real targets are. And so what do? They go after the low-hanging fruit. They go to Luis Rivera, who was charged with first-degree murder and subject to the death penalty. And they tell him, we're going to cut you a deal where you only have to serve 7 more years. 7. You're going to hear discrepancy after discrepancy. You're going to hear problematic evidence with Luis Rivera about Sigfredo Garcia's involvement. And you're going to hear over and over and over that Luis Rivera's story fits the government's theory. Because the target at the end of this case is not these two.
The FBI wiretapped the defendant's phone calls. Magbanawa's defense team is pointing the finger at her co-defendant, saying one of the calls between Garcia and the victim's father-in-law proves she wasn't involved.
The state got a pair, and what their whole theory boils down to is They say that the Adelsons are behind this, but the only link that makes sense is that it had to have gone through Catherine McBanwell to get to these two individuals. But members of the jury, Ms. Kappelman said it to you directly in our opening statement. They have a phone call between Sigfredo Garcia directly to Harvey Adelson. So there's evidence of that communication. They don't want to highlight it because if they can show that there's evidence between Luis Rivera and Sigfredo Garcia directly to Charlie, then their entire theory of Katie's involvement makes absolutely no sense.
Let's bring the panel in on this case. Francie Hakes, I'll start with you. You know, when you've got a case that's this complicated, I look and say, hey, you know, prosecutor probably should have put some pictures up there so the jury can keep all of these entangled people straight. This is really complicated.
You know, Aaron, I was thinking that exact thing when we were watching that, is that she really needed a chart graph and a pointer, a laser pointer over her head, because if the jury is confused in opening statement, it starts off your case on the wrong foot. People don't like to admit it, but juries make up their mind at the very beginning, usually in opening statements. Their minds can be changed. They're not supposed to make up their minds then, but they do. And so you want to make sure you're starting off right. And I thought the prosecution's argument was just very confusing. I think the jury is not going to know who's who. And it's not a good roadmap at this point.
It is not. Jesse Weber, I'm looking at this and saying there was a last-ditch effort to try to sever these cases. This is going to get really awkward where you've got one defendant sitting at a table in close proximity to another defendant. One says they flat out didn't do it, and then the other one is blaming the other defendant. I mean, that's the epitome of awkwardness.
Thank goodness they're not being represented by the same attorney, although that wouldn't have been permitted here. Yeah, I mean, this is not something that we've seen as a surprise. We've seen cases before where you have multiple defendants, multiple attorneys, they're all sitting in the same room. Doesn't mean they're all going to face the same verdict, because the jury at the end of the day has to understand who is the trigger man or trigger men, and then what was the connection? What spurred this? Is she really the only link, or was he directed by somebody else directly? That's the question. And as you said, it's complicated, and both sides have to spell it out pretty clearly.
Latonia, I think the key evidence here is going to be some of the wiretapped phone calls.
Right, and they're going to have to really center in on that. It's like what Francie said is too. We should have had, the prosecution should have done more of like a roadmap, and it's almost like you've got so many plots and twists that you should have had something up there that gave you an idea of who are the people that we're dealing with, the characters in a sense. Who are the people that you're dealing with? So, because jurors take really great notes, and so as they're doing that, they'd be able to keep up and understand what's happening.
Exactly. I think that's what we needed in this case, but we will watch it roll along. Thanks a lot to all of you for your insights here on The Debrief. We're going to head back, for those of you watching on the network, to regular network programming.